I'm Damon Lindelof. I'm the co-creator and executive producer of Lost.
And I am Carlton Cuse, and I am a writer and executive producer of Lost.
Now, you said executive producer, but you're often referred to by a different title, showrunner.
Yeah, that's what we are. I mean, there are a lot of executive producers in Hollywood. People acquire that title, so they had to come up with another term to actually differentiate the people who actually run television shows, who oversee them. And so a showrunner in television is like a director in movies. That is the title given to the person, or in this case, duo, that makes sort of all the final creative decisions.
So that's what you guys do together somehow?
Yes, we are show running, sort of handing the proverbial baton back and forth. We are kind of the vision behind the show, as it were, and we eat, breathe, and sleep Lost from when we wake up to when we go to bed, and as of right now, we've made about 115 hours of it. But we still love each other very, very deeply.
Oh, and you always agree on everything, right?
Yeah. In fact,
That's
but
not
we
true.
don't make eye contact
No.
with each other, and only only directly address each other when we're being interviewed.
Do any of your disagreements then become actual, plot devices for the series itself,
Absolutely. Particularly, there is a sort of latent Red Sox-Yankee rivalry that's sort of embedded in the show. So in various episodes, there are some where, sort of Red Sox triumph, and other ones where there's sort of references to the Yankees triumphing. And that has a lot to do with our individual rooting interests.
Well, thanks for doing this. This is great. You've each sent us several films that you love to watch at home. Let's start with Carlton Cuse. You've got a film called Sweet Dreams from 1985. What is it?
Sweet Dreams is basically the biography of country singer Patsy Cline, and it stars Jessica Lange as Patsy Cline and Ed Harris as her husband, Charlie Dick.
And what draws you to that film?
Well, primarily it was the first movie I really worked on when I started my career in Hollywood, and I worked as an assistant to the producer and also to the director. So I actually learned how a movie got made. I spent 5 months on location in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Nashville, Tennessee, and sort of worked on that movie from start to finish. And, so it made a really vivid impression with me. And actually, I got to see some really interesting behind the scenes things while I was actually making that movie.
You must have a different experience watching that movie than the average person would, just grabbing it off the shelf.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I kind of rewatched it for this interview, it was amazing how all the memories came back of sort of witnessing literally every scene of that movie getting filmed.
Now, who's actually singing the Patsy Cline parts here?
Well, Jessica Lange got an Academy Award nomination for her performance in this movie, and the decision was made to have her lip sync to Patsy Cline's original tracks. And one of the most amazing experiences that I had on the movie was we actually hired Owen Bradley, who was Patsy Cline's original producer, and we took Jessica Lange into his studio in Nashville. And Jessica Lange inhabited the role. I mean, when I first met her, she had just done a movie called Country with Sam Shepard, and she was rail thin, and this was about struggling farmers. And she put on weight and started speaking in this sort of rolling Virginia accent, and she sort of really became the embodiment of Patsy Cline. And so one day we were sitting in the barn with Owen Bradley, and she was practicing the tracks, and Hilda Hensley, who was Patsy Cline's mother, who was still alive at the time, came into the studio, and she saw Jessica Lange doing this, and she just burst into tears. It was incredibly emotional.
Now, because you've each sent in different films, you do have an opportunity here, Damon Lindelof, at any time to say that your partner's that your colleague's selection was completely off base and should never have been on his list at any
Well,
time.
I'd actually never heard Carlton talk about this before, but it does explain why he often lip syncs to Patsy Cline music. Something that made me very uncomfortable to deal with head on, but I guess that's one mystery solved.
Well, if that happens in the premiere of Lost, or in the final episode of Lost, that someone is singing Patsy Cline, we know
Yes.
why and
It,
where that came
well,
from.
actually, you hear a lot of Patsy Cline in Lost because Evangeline Lilly, Kate Austin on the show, almost all the every time we see her, she's actually there's Patsy Cline playing. So we've actually associated her music with that character.
And one other thing, obviously I did know about Carlton's involvement with Sweet Dreams. If you do get the DVD, a fun thing to look for
Oh, no.
is Carlton is actually
No.
in the movie. So if you can
Oh,
find
Damon.
Carlton, you win a prize.
It was actually my acting debut. I mean, literally, the first time I never was in a school play. I was, and the Carol Rice, the director of the movie, I think thought it was funny to put me in the movie. So he made me a soldier at an army base. And I actually, and even though I was at the end of the day wearing a helmet, I got a military haircut and he stabbed me there. And there were 80 crew members. And the first time I was to act, here came Jessica Lange driving up in a car to deliver a line that I had to respond to.
What did you say?
I think I said something very profound, like, go down here and make a left.
And he got that in 15 takes. That's all it took. And he's money in the bank.
Well, that's a complete sentence. I thought you were going to say all you got to say was yes, ma'am.
No, he had a lot of faith in me.
If it weren't for you in that movie, Patsy Cline would still be driving around looking for her destination.
It would have been a very long experimental film.
Absolutely.
You've got a choice here, Damon, The Limey from 1999.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite movies and certainly my favorite Steven Soderbergh movie. First off, I love economy and storytelling. The Limey is actually under 90 minutes. I think it's around 88 or 89 minutes. So it just kind of flies right by you. It's basically a revenge story. Terrence Stamp plays a sort of a career criminal who has basically just gotten out of prison, and his daughter has died in Los Angeles. Supposedly as a result of falling asleep behind the wheel of her car, but he comes out to L.A. because his instincts tell him that this is not the case, and it turns out that his daughter was basically in this sort of very weird relationship with a record producer played by Peter Fonda, and Terrence Stamp becomes convinced that Peter Fonda is actually responsible for her death and then decides to take out revenge on the guy. And so it's a very simple story, but the way that it's told is completely out of order. For those people who watch Lost, they're probably aware that we love nonlinear storytelling, and I think The Limey is a perfect example of this, and it's like a puzzle. And, you know, when I was growing up, I got a job at a movie theater from when I was 14 to when I was 18, and when the ushers would go on break, we'd have 15-minute breaks, and we'd just go into the movie theater, and whatever part of the movie was on, that's the part that we'd watch. So I watched, over the course of 4 years, basically every movie that came out of order. So my brain sort of had to put them together. So, you know, I would go and see Pretty Woman, and I'd see, like, the middle of the movie first, and then I'd go, how did Julia Roberts and Richard Gere meet here? And then, you know, only later would I realize, oh, okay, this is how it happened. But The Limey sort of purposefully does that. But I think the thing that I love most about the movie, especially the DVD, is that Lem Dobbs is the guy who wrote the screenplay. He and Steven Soderbergh get into arguments over and over again on the commentary track of this movie, where Lem Dobbs is basically saying, this was my intent, Steven Soderbergh, and you completely screwed it up. And Soderbergh is basically saying, well, everybody kind of liked it. And what I remember is that there was this movie called A Poor Cow that Terrence Stamp was in back in the 60s, in which Soderbergh uses clips of Stamp as a younger man in it. And so they're talking on the commentary track, is The Limey in fact a sequel to Poor Cow? And Soderbergh says yes, and Lem Dobbs says no, absolutely not. So the guy who wrote it says it is not a sequel, and the guy who directed it says it is. Mm. And you as a storyteller, you basically go, well, you know, is it or isn't it? There's two viable explanations. And again, to extrapolate this back, Carlton and I deal with this very often on Lost, which is, you know, we get asked all the time what our intent was. And we're beginning to realize as the sun is setting on the show that our intent is absolutely non-important. It's really about what people perceive that trumps our intent every single time. So we'll get into conversations with fans when we go, no, we didn't mean to put that there. That wasn't our intention. And they go, yes, it was.
Well, we've got a little bit of The Limey here. This is Terrence Stamp playing this man who's gone to Los Angeles looking for more information about the death of his daughter. Let's listen.
You wrote me about my daughter?
Oh, yeah. Come in.
Who done it then? Snuffed her.
What are you talking about? I sent you the newspaper clipping, okay? I tell you everything I know. I never said anything about anybody being snuffed.
Hmm. You've also got a film here. This is Carlton Cuse's list now, called Children of Men from 2006. And you'll need to explain this for people who haven't seen it. It's a pretty dramatic premise.
Yeah, I mean, basically, Children of Men is a sci-fi buddy road movie with a lot of really cool action. And it's a terrific movie with a terrible title. And I think that that's one of the reasons it was sort of underappreciated. And it's based on a book called Children of Men by P.D. James, which in turn is, I think the title is a Catholic allegory from Psalm 90 of the King James Version. But they should have, you know, Blade Runner, that's a good title for a science fiction movie. This is this suffers from that, but it's a terrific movie, and it was directed by Alfonso Cuarón, who also directed Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban and Y Tu Mamá También. And basically it stars Clive Owen as this sort of ex-activist who is drawn into a plan by his ex-wife, played by Julianne Moore, to transport an illegal named Key, who was eight months pregnant, to the English coast. Now, the thing about this futuristic world is that nobody can have children. The human species has lost the ability to reproduce. So this one pregnant woman sort of represents the future of all humanity. And Clive Owen has lots of really difficult obstacles to overcome on his way to his destination.
Before we talk about that a little bit more, let's listen to a newscast from this future world that is the setting of Children of Men.
The world was stunned today by the death of Diego Ricardo, the youngest person on the planet. Baby Diego was stabbed outside a bar in Buenos Aires after refusing to sign an autograph.
Born in 2009, the son of Marcelo and Silvia Ricardo, a working-class couple from Mendoza, he struggled all his life with the celebrity status thrust upon him as the world's youngest person.
And, of course, the notion there is the world's youngest person would be famous because he was or has been for quite some time the last human being born on Earth. So does this film overcome the problematic title for you?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a tremendous action movie, and the director does some incredible things. I mean, there's sort of this action sequence, and without spoiling the movie, it's basically over 4 minutes, and it's all kind of one continuous shot. And it's really it's a tremendous realization of a future world. I mean, it's a very hard thing to do, particularly on a limited budget, which this movie was made, which is to actually make you feel like you're in a futuristic world that you buy. And this movie does an incredible job with that. And it's also got these amazing little sort of special treats, like Michael Caine is in this movie, and he does this sort of great turn as a futuristic hippie named Jasper Palmer. And this character was supposedly modeled by Caine on his friend John Lennon. And he is absolutely terrific in the movie. And, you know, it's kind of a wonderful movie with sort of great allegories and kind of some wonderful sort of thematics about, you know, the possibilities of hope in a very bleak future.
Because you feel that the title alone may have prevented a great movie from getting the attention it deserved, I'm curious if you guys considered a bunch of other titles before you settled on Lost.
Well, the provenance of the title was basically ABC had a script that they had been developing with Aaron Spelling, the sort of producer of all those great nighttime soaps and
Charlie's Angels
and Melrose Place and 90210, and that it was basically about people crashing on an island and they took their shirts off and had copious sex with each other, and but the show kind of didn't go anywhere from there, and that show was called Nowhere. And I think everybody basically agreed at ABC that Nowhere was sort of a very bad title. You're opening yourself up to the slings and arrows of the critics.
Yeah.
You know.
The premiere reviews were not going to be kind.
Right. So after slightly kicking around somewhere, I think we basically ended up with Lost, which actually ended up being the perfect title because we always wanted it to be a commentary not just on the fact that they were on an island and couldn't get off it, but that these people, you know, quite figuratively were lost in their own lives at the time of the crash, and that somehow by sort of finding community with each other, helping each other overcome whatever their, you know, whatever they needed to be redeemed for in their former lives before they came to this island, that they could in some way kind of be found.
Well, okay, so we're on one-word titles here, maybe, or better. What Damon, caused you to list the film Time Crimes on your DVD recommendations here?
This is, you know, one of my favorite things about movies, especially foreign films, is how they can completely sort of slip under your radar. And a friend of mine, this guy, Paul Soder, who is in the comedy troupe Broken Lizard, sent me an email saying, have you ever seen Time Crimes? And basically, Carlton and I and the rest of the writers on Lost spent an amazing amount of time last year in the fifth season of the show doing what we affectionately refer to as the time travel season. And we would, you know, be up until the wee hours of the morning sort of bending our brains around the sort of paradoxes, or the grandfather paradox, as it were, which is if you go back in time and you murder your own grandfather, do you cease to exist?
And don't even start with all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'm not going to start.
There are a thousand science fiction films that have, or science fiction stories even, that have pursued that notion.
Absolutely. Sure. And so we wanted to take, you know, do our own take on it. And Lost basically adopted the strategy of, no matter how hard you try, there's nothing you can do to actually change the future. It's a what happened, happened. It's a fait accompli kind of time travel storytelling. And my buddy Paul basically emailed me and said, you should check out this movie. So it's a Spanish film made by a guy named Nacho Vigalondo. He directed this incredible short film called 7:35 in the Morning, which was nominated actually for an Academy Award. That's what got him sort of international recognition. And then and that film is actually on the Time Crimes DVD and is just as good as Time Crimes. But it's the kind of storytelling that we happen to love, which is you drop into the middle of a story and you have no idea what's going on until about midway through. It's very simple. There are only four characters in the entire movie. And it basically starts with a guy who is at home with his wife. And he sees this dude in the woods whose face is wrapped up in these very bloody bandages. And the guy basically goes in pursuit of this man and thus begins the story. And the filmmaker actually plays sort of a key role in the movie. He plays the sort of Johnny the Explainer role. This is another phrase we use in Lost, which is every once in a while, Johnny the Explainer needs to sort of come strolling out of the jungle and tell you what the hell is going on. but in this case, in Time Crimes, not to spoil too much, what we love is when Johnny the Explainer is completely unreliable. And this is something that is used in The Usual Suspects, another one of my favorite movies. But when the person who's narrating the movie is sometimes lying to you, it can make for a very interesting story.
And there must be a fine line, though, between letting people be mystified for a while and let that be the suspense and causing people to be confused and maddened by a film. There must be an art to staying on the right side of that line.
What are you getting
at,
Steve?
It's a very fine line.
Wait a minute here.
If we can find it, we'll let you know.
Yeah.
I wasn't implying anything about any particular television series.
Yes, you were, Steve.
It's okay. We've heard it all before. But in our opinion, Time Crimes is a movie that when it ends, it is a perfect ending. It sticks the landing. There are no sort of dangling threads. Every single question you have going through it is sort of answered, and it's tied up in a neat little bow. And that, I feel, is the movie's sort of crowning achievement.
Another thing on your list here, this is Carlton Cuse's list, is The Prisoner. What's that about?
The Prisoner is one of the great kind of classic television shows of all times. And it was made in 1968. It's a British series. And they only made 17 episodes of it, but it still has this incredible, profound legacy. And it basically stars Patrick McGoohan as a spy who resigns his job with the British Intelligence Service. And he goes home and he's basically gassed. And when he comes to, he is in this mysterious seaside village, just referred to as the village. And he's a prisoner there, and everyone in this village basically is referred to by a number, and he's number six. And the village is led by number two, and you don't know who number one is. And it was absolutely mesmerizing. I saw this as a kid, and it was so different than any other television shows, because television shows and basically television in general, you know, the kind of goal always with networks is to make everything explicit, to make sure that you really understand everything. And this show was incredibly mysterious and very purposely ambiguous. And it had a huge influence on me, and I think and also Damon, and I think it became really a cornerstone series that we referred to in creating Lost, because just the power of creating these really unsettling mysteries was, I think, first done in this series really effectively.
Now, when you talk about a sprawling and complex mystery, that gets us to the final choice that we have on the list here. Huh. Damon's choice. This is Spinal Tap.
Yes. This is Spinal Tap is probably, in my opinion, one of the funniest films ever made. And my own personal experience with it, I think the movie came out in 1984 or 1985, because I was around 11 or 12, I think, when it came out. And I went to go see it in the theater with my dad. And when I saw it, I had no comprehension of what a mockumentary was. So when I saw it, I was like, this is a real band. They actually make music. I have never really heard of them, but they are very, very, very funny guys. A lot of the jokes sort of went over my head, but mm-hmm. the way that I sort of experienced it was, you know, we were going to see a documentary about a rock band. And the second time that I saw it, you know, was I was at, you know, in college at NYU, and I was talking about this documentary that I had seen and really liked, and everyone was looking at me like I was the hugest idiot of all time. And they said, you know that that's not real, that those guys were like on Saturday Night Live. That's Michael McKean and Harry Shearer and Rob Reiner directed. And I go, yeah, I know he directed it. He's talking to the camera, but he said his name is Marty something. And so then I watched the movie the second time, and it's amazing, because that movie, you know, shows you, you know, when you watch it with the perspective of, oh my God, this was written, you know, as opposed, it was, you know, I mean, I guess it's not hard to pull the wool over a 12-year-old's eyes, but, you know, to look at the movie through an entirely different prism, it took on an entirely new life. And I know that I'm, you know, that I'm a big advocate of the commentary track on DVDs, but let's be honest, you know, that's kind of one of the best parts of watching them from a writer's perspective. And the great thing about the Spinal Tap DVD is those guys do the commentary in character. They're so committed to the reality of this world. It's really a monumental achievement in sort of comedy filmmaking. And I think when you look at television shows like The Office, both the UK edition and the American version, and now Modern Family, the idea of faux documentary was really kind of invented and catalyzed by This Is Spinal Tap. And no matter when that movie is on, I will watch it from wherever I flick the channel until it ends. I like it that much.
Let's listen to a little bit of This Is Spinal Tap. We hear here Christopher Guest, who's playing a rock musician, and he's showing his room full of guitars to Rob Reiner, who's playing the director of this film. Let's listen.
This one is just, it's perfect. 1959, you know, it just, you can, listen.
How much is this?
Just listen for a minute. Sustain, listen to it.
I'm not hearing anything.
You would, though, if it were playing, because it really, it's famous for its sustain. I mean, you can just hold it.
Well, I mean, so you'd have to put...
You can go and have a bite. No, you'd still be hearing that one.
Yeah.
You talked about them being really committed to the role in the commentary alongside. Isn't that the key to something like this? You can never wink at the audience or the film dies. You have to be totally sincere seeming all the way through.
That's it. And, you know, and what's amazing about the movie is they don't always go for the joke. There are moments of, you know, the movie is really about the sort of falling out between, you know, the lead singer of the band played by Michael McKean and sort of the lead guitarist played by Christopher Guest. And, you know, obviously this sort of mimics, you know, similar relationships in bands like the Beatles and the Who. And, you know, it's a love story between these two guys. And Nigel's girlfriend, you know, is basically sort of the Yoko in this drama. But you're really rooting for these guys to sort of, you know, reconcile and get back together, because the fact of the matter is it's sort of like over for the band. They're playing, you know, the sort of revealing moment in the movie is they have to go play a gig at a theme park, and they look at the marquee and it says Puppet Show and Spinal Tap with it misspelled. And you know, it's like the Puppet Show got top billing. So, you know, but, you know, there's real emotion there, and that only is derived from the fact that they're completely committed to the reality of their world. And again, to kind of bring it back around to Lost, because let's be honest, Carlton and I are have to prostitute our own show, is that the show can be so – we look at each other all the time in the writers' room, all the writers, and go, this is the most ridiculous show in the history of television shows. What the hell do we think we're doing? But I think – in our writing, we have to be so committed to the fact that it's not ridiculous that somehow you basically are never aware of the true. If you're trying to describe it to someone who's never seen the show, they're going to look at you like you're a crazy person.
Yeah, but thank God for our brilliant actors who basically take these crazy premises and premises and they just, they're fully committed, and it is a lot like Spinal Tap. I mean, they give everything to every scene, no matter how ridiculous the concept is behind it. And that's what sells it. And I think, if you know, storytelling is a lot about conviction. And we feel like if you're committed as a writer and the actors are committed, then the audience will go along for the ride.
So answer one question for me about the finale of Lost.
Maybe.
Just one question.
Absolutely.
Just one question. I'm not even going to really ask what it is, because I have a feeling I know the answer to this question. I just want to hear you say.
It's just between us.
Is it all going to turn out to be a dream?
No, We promise you that. I mean, one of the things that we were very concerned about is that given the fact that people have invested so much time in our show, if we had a sort of this all takes place in a snow globe kind of ending, we would be killed.
Okay, so what else is it not going to be? Don't tell me what it's going to be. Just tell me something else it's not going to be.
Well, just
it's not going to be a vision in the dog's brain.
Yeah, visions or dreams are definitely out. Some people have implied that the island might be a spacecraft and
that
it will be lifting
off
at the end of the show.
That
might be happening, but
probably not.
Probably not. I would not place any bets on that.
What are you guys working on next?
We're so busy with Lost right now, it's hard to think about it. I mean, we're putting in sort of 60 to 80-hour weeks for the next few months trying to get the scripts finished and the show finished. And we have like 11 different episodes in states of completion right now. So I think we need to take a little break and figure that out.
How many episodes ahead are you at this point?
We're writing in the writer's room. We're basically working on the 14th episode of 17.
And we're shooting the 12th one right now.
Okay, so you got a little lead time, but not a lot.
We're about 8 days ahead of the camera right now in terms of the writing.
We have been actually writing while doing this interview with you. So if episode 14 is subpar, it's your fault, Steve.
I wondered what that little clicking sound was in the background, a little keyboard or something.
Exactly.
Well, Carlton and Damon, thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.